Looking to diversify your business portfolio with a high-growth opportunity? Discover Mathnasium Learning Centers, the number one math-only education franchise. For more than 20 years, Mathnasium has triumphed in a booming multi-billion-dollar tutoring industry with over 1,200 centers worldwide. Ranked on Entrepreneur's Franchise 500 list for 11 consecutive years, Mathnasium is low-cost, recession-resistant, and offers significant growth potential in an expanding market. The demand for math education is skyrocketing, driven by declining math scores and the growing need for STEM skills in today's workforce. What makes Mathnasium a smart investment? Affordable entry point and quick build-out time. High-earning centers with seven-figure annual revenue, industry-leading 30% plus average profit margins, and it's a trusted brand with high consumer satisfaction scores. And here's something extra. They're offering a 25% discount on the franchise fee for former teachers and veterans. So whether you're expanding your franchise portfolio or making your first investment, Mathnasium gives you the systems and support you need to succeed. Get your free franchise information kit at mathnasiumfranchise.com or call 888-763-2604. That's mathnasiumfranchise.com or call 888-763-2604. Hey, it's Dan Bova from Entrepreneur.com, and thanks for joining us for How Success Happens. So, Andy Richter calls today's guest a, quote, bona fide weirdo with virtually no interest in satisfying anything other than his own personal obsessions. The weirdo in question is Mike Sachs, a comedy writer who has built something of an industry writing novelizations of movies that don't exist and memoirs of people who were never born, and then turning them into audiobooks voiced by real people who happen to be the funniest people on earth. He's got a new book out in April called This Is How We Love, which I'm going to leave to him to explain because it is completely bonkers. And I don't mean that lightly. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for having me. It's good to see you again.
Great to see you again, too. So you write in such a specific way, and you've created this. It's your brain folds in half three times while reading, including this new book that is a, well, why don't you explain what it is, and then I'll give you my reaction.
Yeah, and what you just mentioned is something that has intrigued and saddened me in a sense. I can't just write something simple. I don't think I'm wired for that. I wish I could, but I don't have the talent, I think, just to produce something simple. So sometimes I think it's too complicated and I get too far up my own ass with the stuff. I mean, if you can't even explain this, this is not an elevator pitch we're talking about.
No. I'm exaggerating my befuddlement because honestly, upon opening this book, I immediately laughing my ass off. So
well, I really appreciate that. But I have confused many people, including my own family. I mean, for many years, my parents are now deceased, but they thought these movies were real, like, and nothing I could say could convince them otherwise. These are not books you're going to find in the airport bookstore or in a Barnes & Noble. So they are a little special in a sense. The newest book is a photo novel, and these used to exist when I was a kid, and you would have, say, Battlestar Galactica or Star Wars, and there would be stills from the movie. And then beneath each of the stills, it'd either be dialogue or some sort of narration explaining the plot. So I wanted to do my overall idea was to make fun of the movies that came out in the 90s that would win these Oscar Academy Awards, but would be just unwatchable a few years later. Mr. Holland's Opus, Parenthood, you know, what have you. So I wanted to make the worst movie to have ever won the best Academy Award. And I wanted it to take place in the 90s. And instead of writing a novelization, I thought it'd be fun to gather actors and comedians to pose. And they would pose in front of a white screen My photographer friend, Seth Olenek, who photographs comedy stars and comedians and actors, would shoot it. And then a digital computer expert would then redesign it to make it look like it came from this movie. That was the right idea. And that was 4 years ago. So it has gone through a lot of phases, a lot of difficulty. The most difficult part, there's no AI used in this, no trickery. So it was all hand done.
Yeah.
To find someone willing to work on 200 photos to make it look like a 1990s movie. Yeah. So, for what I was willing to pay, not easy.
Right.
So I had to go through two people, ended up on a third. She worked out eventually, but it took about 4 years to get everything together. And I wanted it visual rather than just pure text, like in some of my other books. I also wanted it to be like an art book where you would have the 200 photos explaining the plot, but you would also have a behind the scenes. You would have a history of the movie written by a fake movie specialist. And then you would have trivia about the characters. You would have information about the porn parody that came after that was called This Is How We Rub. And I got Paul Feig to pose for that. Actually, I shouldn't even say that because he didn't know what he was posing for. And I haven't heard from him since I sent him the book. So I don't know how happy he is with that. In the book, he's the director and the writer of This Is How We Rub, which was the porn parody of This Is How We Love. And then I got Amy Sedaris to pose as a character who never made final cut of the film. She was a B actress, supposedly in the 1970s and 80s, starred in a lot of drive-in movies, posed for this movie, but then died of a heart attack while she was shooting, while these photos were being taken place. So that's the overall summary of the book. Again, not an elevator pitch that you can explain to people easily. And it really did sort of, you know, certain books need to be a certain length. And for some reason, I felt this book needed to be over 350 pages. So yeah, it's kind of a monster.
It's a beautiful monster though. So let me just explain to people some of the names that appear in this book. John Hamm, Paul Rubens, Patton Oswalt, Chris Maloney, Lorraine Newman, Amy Sedaris, as you just said, Amber Tamblyn, David Cross. There are a lot of very funny people in this book. And I guess my question about the creation, as you just mentioned with Feig, is like, did they know what they were doing, or did you just like make a bunch of weird poses and I'm going to write the story from that? Like, what came first?
Yeah, well, they had no idea what they were doing. I mean, I sent them a basic concept, which was this is going to be a photo book based off the worst movie to have ever won the Best Academy Award back in 1994. That was it. They had no idea what it was going to be. For instance, John Hamm had no idea it would eventually be, he'd be playing an astronaut suffering from impotence because he lit a cigar in the capsule that he was on in space and blew up all of his fellow astronaut. No idea. But quite frankly, I didn't know what it was. So, and to give these actors and comedians props, I mean, they had no idea what they were getting into, which is not something they traditionally like. They like to know what they're getting into. And just the fact that they said yes means so much to me.
Yeah.
Just to trust me enough to do this, because that you really are. I mean, there are shots of John Hamm without his shirt. And like, right. who would do that? What other major star would do that? I mean, what?
Yeah.
Great guy. I love him.
Yeah.
But a real sense of trust. And I just, I'm so grateful that they trusted me for this. I'm just so happy that they did this.
Well, they have good reason to trust you. So this isn't your first outing here. So for people who might not know some of your back catalog, so Stinker Let's Loose was a novelization of those kind of like trucker movies from the 70s, right?
That's right.
And then you had Passable in Pink, which was an 80s kind of novelization. And I bring those up, too, because you did audiobooks of these. And some of the people that we've mentioned, particularly John Hamm, lent their voices to these. So can you give us a sense of how all of this really came to be?
Yeah. So a number of years ago, I separated from my wife. and we were getting a divorce. And I sort of went through an epiphany of sorts because I had interviewed a lot of comedians and actors and studied the careers of those comedy writers who I just absolutely adored, whether it was Richard Pryor, George Carlin, Albert Brooks, or whomever. And there seemed to be a common theme, which was they stopped doing the comedy that they didn't necessarily want to do for others and started doing it for themselves. If you look at the early George Carlin, early Richard Pryor, it's very G-rated, maybe PG-rated. But once they let loose and they felt free and started to fly, that's when the comedy really came together. So I was going through sort of a bad time. I was writing books through traditional publishing. I was writing for magazines, New Yorker, Esquire, Vanity Fair. But I really wasn't that happy. I was writing for what I thought editors wanted to read, what readers wanted to read. And I just thought at a certain point that I just have to do something that interests me. And whether 10 people read it, it'll be okay because I'll have something tangible that I liked to do and that it would be fun for me to do and something I would like to read if it was out there. So the idea that I had, which I had for a while, was to write a novelization based off of a non-existent movie. And I didn't have a camera. I didn't have access to actors or directors. This was really the only way I could do such a thing is to, parody and satirize a movie was just to create it myself as a novelization. I thought it was a good Trojan horse. Yeah. So what I wanted to do was go after a genre that I thought had been sort of forgotten, which was the late 70s CB radio. And if you didn't grow up in that time, it's hard to express just how popular it was. I mean, Jimmy Carter was in office. This is pre-Reagan. Southern culture was at its height. Southern music, Dukes of Hazzard on TV. CB radios would be in cars. My aunt had one. She was 4'11" Jewish woman in Pittsburgh. She went by Honey Bear as a CB call sign. So it was really, really big. And I was very small at the time, but I grew up in Virginia and Maryland. I would be taken to these drive-ins and I would see these CB movies and they were sort of my Star Wars. I really, really loved them, but they sort of been forgotten. Yeah. So I wanted to make fun of that. And not just the movies, which I truly love, is go after the time. It was a very specific time before things went different with Reagan. Pop culture then moved north. It became urban with rap, which I also love, but it wasn't Southern rural. And I just thought I would capture that moment. So I thought I would write this novelization based off of a character named Stinker, who was sort of like Smokey of Smokey and the Bandit, played by Burt Reynolds. And I honestly felt 10 people will read this thing at most. But at least I'm having fun writing it and it'll be fun to put out and it'll be fun to design. And I did put it out and expected really nothing. And I sent it out and maybe a week later, a guy I knew, Eric Martin, who works in audio and he's a narrator. He reached out to me and said, can I have the rights to this? And I thought, yeah, sure. You can have the rights to this. It's not, who in God's name would want this? A week later, he calls me back and said, John Hamm is interested. Would you like for him to play Stinker? And then a week after that, Ray Seahorn is interested. Would you be okay with her playing the lead female role? So it was just one of those things. Now, I had knew John a little bit beforehand. I knew Ray from my earlier books, but I had not reached out to them. It was someone else doing it. But it was the type of thing where, and I tell this to young writers, until you put something out there that's tangible, people may have a hard time imagining it. But once it's out there, something that has weight to it, that you can hold in your hand, it becomes real to them. Now, in the case of John Hamm, his father worked in the trucking industry in Missouri.
Yeah.
Growing up. So he had that personal connection to it, which I had no idea. Ray Seahorn grew up in Virginia Beach, not far from where I grew up. So she knew that culture as well. So when something exists that didn't exist before, good things can happen. And that was a lesson for me. Now, you do have to spend a number of months actually writing this thing, not knowing whether someone will be interested or not. But the lesson for me was by putting out something that I love and I thought maybe a few other people would love and just having it out there and existing can make all the difference.
Now, I remember talking to you when Stinker Lets Loose first came out and What was so amazing was that you self-published this. Talk about making things happen for yourself. You told me that you just were so exhausted with the prospect of having to explain it to an agent and then that agent trying to explain it to a book publisher. Can you talk a little bit about that decision to just cut through all of that and just do it yourself?
Yeah, no, it's a good question, but I knew even beforehand because I had pitched ideas to my agent at that time, and there was no understanding. And I've noticed this over the years that the humor sensibility that I have, that you have, that a lot of my friends have, that John Hamm has, Ray Seahorn has, doesn't necessarily match the sensibility of agents, producers,
right,
and others. Now, I'm not saying, you know, the humor IQ is higher. It's just different. And what they want, and this would be agents that I've dealt with in the past, is something you would find in the comedy section of a Barnes & Noble, whether it's cat versus dogs or historical Trump tweets, or
whatever it might be.
That is what they're looking for. That is what the general public, they feel, would be interested in. So this is an idea that I knew had absolutely no chance being purchased by, first of all, an agent, and then being sold to an executive, and then being accepted by an executive up the ladder. I mean, the chance of that happening was nil. Now, with that said, I tried with this latest book. I was just curious to see if the times might have changed. So I sent it to my agent and other agents just out of curiosity, and there was total befuddlement. So really nothing has changed. And this is something that I also tell young comedy writers: if you want to write for print and if you want to write books, you have an opportunity now that has never existed before. And that is, you can put out a book how you want, and you can get it out there, and you can compete with the major publishers. This has never, ever existed before. In the end, I found you do everything by yourself anyway, even if you do publish through a traditional publisher. You write it yourself. You mostly edit it yourself. And if you're smart, you'll have design. You'll be in charge of the design. And in the end, you market it yourself, because a lot of times marketers for traditional publishers don't know what to do with comedy.
Right.
So it's up to you anyway to do all these things. So if that is the case, what you're foregoing is perhaps a small advance payment, but you are gaining total creative control and more of the profits once a book is out and begins to sell.
Looking to diversify your business portfolio with a high growth opportunity? Discover Mathnasium Learning Centers, the number one math-only education franchise. For more than 20 years, Mathnasium has triumphed in a booming multi-billion dollar tutoring industry with over 1,200 centers worldwide. Ranked on Entrepreneur's Franchise 500 list for 11 consecutive years, Mathnasium is low-cost, recession-resistant, and offers significant growth potential in an expanding market. The demand for math education is skyrocketing, driven by declining math scores and the growing need for STEM skills in today's workforce. What makes Mathnasium a smart investment? Affordable entry point and quick build-out time. High-earning centers with seven-figure annual revenue. Industry-leading 30% plus average profit margins. And it's a trusted brand with high consumer satisfaction scores. And here's something extra. They're offering a 25% discount on the franchise fee for former teachers and veterans. So whether you're expanding your franchise portfolio or making your first investment, Mathnasium gives you the systems and support you need to succeed. Get your free franchise information kit at mathnasiumfranchise.com or call 888-763-2604. That's mathnasiumfranchise.com or call 888-763-2604.
So a really important piece of that puzzle, because you mentioned, you know, you wrote the book and then you sent it out. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that whole sent it out part of the process, because you know, some people, not everyone, but some people do get to the end. They type the end and they go through the process and they've got this book. But it's tough to get people's attention. So how did you go about making sure you sent it to people who you thought this would resonate with and, you know, could build from there?
You mean once the book was completed?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So that's a very specific thing. I have been on the receiving end of marketing, book marketing. I used to work or still work at Vanity Fair, but I'm not in the office. I would receive a ton of review copies of books from marketers, and they would be sent out in a mass mailing. And I would receive books that have no connection with Vanity Fair, books on poetry, other types of books. And they would just end up in the free pile, what we call the free pile, which you just throw your book into this, basically this dumpster. And then these books would then end up being sold by interns, usually at used bookstores. Right. So you would, these authors would find their books illegally sold even before the book came out. They'd get no money from it.
Yeah.
And it'd be sold in, you know, these New York bookstores and Amazon and what have you. So I knew what to avoid. And what I do now is it's very pinpoint. I have a list of maybe 50 to 75 people that I will write to individually. I think it's important to write to them individually rather than sending out a mass email.
Yeah.
And tailor each of the emails to them. It does take time. And I've told this to authors. It's the process of marketing a book is a job. And that's the job you have after a book comes out. So it's a months-long process. I reach out to very specific people, asking them if they might be interested in a review copy. And these are people who I know whose sensibility will match mine, whether they're writers like yourself or they are social media people in social media, with Patton Oswalt or Andy Richter or what have you. Because one mention from Andy Richter, one mention from Patton Oswalt is worth more than any review in any newspaper.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't really think anything is worth as much as that now.
Yes, 100%. That is so awesome. So the nonfiction books that we've touched on a little bit, Poking a Dead Frog and The Kicker Is, you've talked to all these incredible comedians over the years, and I'm wondering, is there anyone whose words really kind of stuck with you, things that you think about all the time that have really shaped the way you approach your writing?
Yes, very much so. So I interviewed maybe 60 writers total for both of those books you mentioned, maybe 40 ended up in the final product. So not all the interviews work, but what I did find with the interviews that did work, across the board, there were similarities, and the similarities were this, that really you can't get into comedy writing for the money. If you do it for the money, you're going to end up not being very happy and probably not end up with any money.
Right.
You have to go into comedy writing for the reason you initially go into it, because you enjoy it and you make your friends laugh and it makes you happy. So once you get into it, you really have to hold true to your own comedic sensibility. You can't write what you think others might want. And that's a mistake I made for a long time. You really do have to stick to your guns. Now, it may take a number of years to find your voice.
Yeah.
But once you do, you should really stick to that voice and never stop. And that was a big piece of advice, and that came from Mel Brooks, from Adam Resnick, and others, Adam McKay as well, that there will be ups, there will be downs, but you can't stop. You have to keep going. You know, it's a very interesting career, because it's almost like you're in a carnival. You joined a carnival or something. You're not showing up every day to an office park to work as an accountant.
Right, you know? Right.
So you're going to have ups, but you're also going to have downs. But
yeah,
the trick is not to give up and to keep on moving. Now, with that said, it's easy to give up, or it's easy to get down on yourself and your writing, because you're going to find that you're going to be rejected, sometimes rightly, sometimes wrongly. But you have to have a lodestar that guides you, and that it carries you through the bad times. And I was lucky enough where I did have bad times, both personally and professionally, where I just thought, screw it, threw it to the wind, and hope for the best. And that really was what I had heard these authors say. You just have to have like a punk aesthetic, balls, like yeah. John Waters, where God knows what his family was saying about his movies.
Right,
right. I mean, John Waters is a guy who's really, his work meant a tremendous amount to me. Total punk aesthetic. Grew up about 50 miles north of where I grew up. He grew up in Lutherville, Maryland, north of Baltimore. And he, as a maybe a 21-year-old, 22-year-old, reenacted the Zapruder film on the streets of Lutherville, Maryland, with Divine playing Jackie O. Now, how ballsy is that? Now, God knows he received some negative words about that.
Right.
Didn't give a shit. I mean, the strength of character that he has,
yeah,
is so strong. And that too was a big lesson for me, not just with John, but the punk aesthetic across the board. I also grew up close to Ian MacKaye of Fugazi and Minor Threat. And what they were doing in the 80s and 90s was doing their own thing, how they wanted it, putting it out and then moving on.
Yeah.
And that to me was almost like a magic trick. I had never seen, I mean, to put out your own records in the 80s and 90s,
yeah,
the way you wanted to do that. And they put out great music the way they wanted to. And because of that, they succeeded and actually can live off the proceeds from those records that they put out all those years ago.
That's awesome. And, you know, I think just that message about being resilient is so great, because, you know, I talk to people who are, you know, creators, people who are running companies, and, you know, everyone falls on their face at some point. How do you personally keep going when things aren't going exactly right?
Yeah, there's never any sense like this is definitely going to hit. There's always a sense of, will this hit? I mean, even when something is out and I think it's good, there's always a sense of this could be a total bomb. The trick really is to not give a shit. Everyone has failure. And unless you're a doctor and you lost a patient on the table, I know creators who have put out books that didn't do well with reviewers or movies they put out that didn't do well, and it ruined them. They couldn't get past that. And I think it's so important to know that, listen, it's just a book, or it's just a movie, or it's just a stand-up routine. You can learn from it and move on. You do not have to circle the drain for the rest of your life.
Right, right, right.
Because that's the sort of hell that I wouldn't wish on anyone.
Yeah.
I also think it's important not to have to rely on others. If you're waiting for the phone to ring, if you're waiting for permission to be published or to get up on stage or to write for a show, that's not a good position to be in. Time seems to go very slow, and you tend to get wounded very easily if it doesn't work out. I'm all about making your own opportunities. And I think we're lucky enough now to be in a world where you can make your own opportunities. So that's what I would also suggest to younger writers, is go out there and make your own opportunities. Make it happen. Don't wait for the permission to do anything. You can do anything on your own now. And some of the best comedy is typically discovered by from these creators who are doing it in the middle of nowhere,
yep,
just doing their own thing. And it will find an audience if it's different and if it's good enough.
That's great. That's awesome. Well, I think that is a great end note, inspiring note. So, Mike, where can people find your books, and how can they follow you?
Oh, thanks. Yeah. So MikeSacks.com. That's SACKS.com. And all my books are listed there. The current book, This Is How We Love, can be found on Barnes & Noble, Amazon, most book sites, but it's on the front page of MikeSacks.com. So it's pretty easy to find.
Excellent. And is there one frame from this movie that never happened that makes you wish to God that it really did happen?
I would say just any shot of John Hamm baring his chest with a necklace that he's wearing in real life. And actually him posing next to Paul Rubens meant a lot to me too, because Paul, yeah, was another guy whose work meant a tremendous amount to me. And I actually became friends with him. No one knew, including me, that he was as sick as he was. And this turned out to be his very last role. And
wow,
I almost get choked up saying it, because his work meant so much to me. Yeah. And he never said a word to me. He didn't say a word to John, who was with him that day when they were shooting these photos. But all the shots of Paul mean so much to me, because he was sick and very sick. And I think he knew he was dying, but yet he took time out of his day to do this ridiculous project. I mean, that's a mensch, and that's a good man.
Yeah. Wow.
So those are the photos I really treasure.
That's incredible. That's so incredible. And I mean, just these names that you're talking about, like John Hamm will be paid literally millions and millions of dollars to be in something.
I know.
And for him to be, I'll bounce over to the photo studio.
These guys are just, I was thinking, people ask me, how much did you pay John? I was like, pay John? I didn't pay him shit. Like, what is he looking for from me? I have nothing. This guy was in these movies. He's just a really decent person that comes through in his work. And that's another thing with people who are decent. It sort of comes through in their work, whether it's comedy people or they're just good people. And they got into the business for the right reasons, to have fun. And this is why they got into it. And they're willing to take on these jobs, these one-day jobs. Like Lorraine Newman, God knows she has millions of things. She has to do this for me. Like, she doesn't need this shit. She's just a really good person who is into comedy for the right reasons. And that's another thing that John is, you know, he's in it for the right reasons. He'll show up. He'll be interviewed. He doesn't charge you. It's just, I'm just incredibly lucky that these people are out there. There's a lot of jerks out there. But the goal really is to find people who are not jerks, people you want to work with, you want to be with, to create a family that you maybe didn't have growing up. And I've been lucky enough to do that. I'm just so fortunate. I mean, I never, ever thought I would be in this position. I worked retail for 10 years in Maryland behind a government housing project. I just never dreamed I would be able to publish one thing, let alone do this. And it's just, I'm very fortunate.
That's awesome. That's fantastic. And given that you are a jerk, it's amazing that you pulled off this magic trick.
I know. It's the irony is delicious, isn't it?
That's our show. Thanks so much to Mike Sachs. Be sure to pick up his book, This Is How We Love. I promise you it will not disappoint. You can listen to more awesome interviews like this by subscribing to How Success Happens. You could also check out clips of this show and others by following Entrepreneur at Entrepreneur on all social media channels. Also check out our YouTube channel for full-length video and video clips. And if you are digging the sweet, sweet sounds of Nika RPM, who happened to be playing this theme song, that's right, this theme song, Nika RPM, you can check them out on Bandcamp.
Looking to diversify your business portfolio with a high growth opportunity? Discover Mathnasium Learning Centers, the number one math-only education franchise. For more than 20 years, Mathnasium has triumphed in a booming multi-billion dollar tutoring industry with over 1,200 centers worldwide. Ranked on Entrepreneur's Franchise 500 list for 11 consecutive years, Mathnasium is low-cost, recession-resistant, and offers significant growth potential in an expanding market. The demand for math education is skyrocketing, driven by declining math scores and the growing need for STEM skills in today's workforce. What makes Mathnasium a smart investment? Affordable entry point and quick build-out time. High-earning centers with seven-figure annual revenue, industry-leading 30% plus average profit margins, and it's a trusted brand with high consumer satisfaction scores. And here's something extra. They're offering a 25% discount on the franchise fee for former teachers and veterans. So whether you're expanding your franchise portfolio or making your first investment, Mathnasium gives you the systems and support you need to succeed. Get your free franchise information kit at mathnasiumfranchise.com or call 888-763-2604. That's mathnasiumfranchise.com or call 888-763-2604.